It's interesting, once you become aware of these rules, you'll see these sort of things all the time. But probably the most important rule about composition is use it to tell your story better. So,
this is Superfast Business with James Schramko. James Schramko. Helping you build your business super fast.
James Schramko here from superfastbusiness.com. And this episode is going to be all about web video. And when it comes to web video, you look for a web video expert. So I actually have a really good friend called Ryan, and he's been making films for over 15 years. He's got lots of industry experience. He's been to the film school. He's set up his own corporate video production business called Dream Engine. And he works with people to connect their audience better using video. So he's the perfect person for this. The thing that I like about Ryan is that he has really good video standards, and he's been instrumental in helping me improve my video. And I've still got a long way to go, so I've got plenty more questions, and we're going to cover those today. Ryan also has a web video marketing show on the iTunes platform, so make sure you look out for that. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, James. Good to be here, and great to be chatting about one of my favorite topics.
Well, you know, it's just becoming more and more important. We know how popular YouTube is. We all have the ability to film ourselves with the technology sitting in our pocket. But I do want to cover things like whether we should be using the technology that's in our pocket, or whether we should be hiring a professional firm like yours to come out and make videos. So probably my starting point with this is, assuming that video is important, and I don't think many people would argue that, why do you think good quality video matters, versus just getting the content out there?
So with the explosion of video production on things like YouTube, and some of it being of, you know, different sorts of quality, there's a bit of a trend at the moment of people saying, you know, don't get hung up on the technical side. It's all about the content. Just get out there and shoot some stuff and get it out there, and don't worry if the quality's a little bit rough. And I mean, I'd agree only so far as to say, don't let perfectionism hold you back from implementing. But what I would say is, you know, avoid thinking of the technical side as a limitation of your creative expression, because as you progressively master the creative side, it's actually going to enhance your creativity. It'll improve the palette of what you have to work with, and you'll have more of a creative vocabulary to express yourself. And, you know, I think of it this way. Would you prefer to have a well-designed contemporary website, or, you know, a logo designed by a graphic designer? Or, you know, on the other hand, would you be happy with a few squiggles on the back of a serviette? Because the truth is, branding really matters, and design really matters. So the way I think of it is, having a dodgy video, it's like going to a meeting wearing an old shirt with a bit of food spilled down the side. You're still saying the same stuff, but your message is just not going to penetrate as well, because you're going to be judged on your physical appearance. You know, it's just human nature. So that's why I think the technical side is really important as well.
Love it. Yeah, I'm really keen to cover the technical side, because as someone who's putting out a video every few days, I've been through those phases. I look at my videos from a year or so ago, and there's wind noise that they're impossible to listen to. I'm right in the middle of the screen, all the rookie errors. What I want to do today is I want to just cut it down to the most absolute essential things that can help the home-based or small operator with some basic or medium equipment get good quality videos out there. Like, lift the quality. What are the things that we need to do to get that quality up in a short, easy method?
Okay, cool. So we're going to just concentrate on the filming side. We're not going to look at things like content or distribution or script writing or all, you know, that sort of stuff, like, you know, what you cover in things like Content Assault and Own the Race Course. I would divide the most important things to focus on into four sections, and they are, firstly, developing the eye of a filmmaker, sound, lighting, and then composition. So, you know, let's go through those.
Okay, I've got to ask you, what is filmmaker's eye?
You know, I think of the filmmaker's eye as opposed to the normal eye, you know, your normal eyes that you see the world with. there's another way of looking at it, and that's through the eye of a filmmaker. And this is, you know, to me, one of the most exciting things about making videos is that once you get into it, you'll never see the world in the same way again, because you become much more tuned into the visual world around you. You start to notice how light works, and you start to see how a camera sees, which is different to the way that your eye sees. So when you're in a place where you're going to do some filming, tune into your physical environment and think about what the light's doing. You know, is it a bright sunny day with harsh shadow-inducing light? Is it a cloudy day with soft flattering light? If you're inside, you know, where's the light coming from? Are there down lights, you know, shining down, creating a bit of an orange glow on people's faces and shadows under their eyes? Start to tune into, you know, the visuals around you. And, you know, once you start to understand how light's working around you, you can set up your shot in a way that's going to get you the best result.
Awesome. Yeah, I know what you mean. I've looked at some of my videos. I have like skeleton eyes, like they're black sockets where I've been punched in the eyes. I didn't know anything about that stuff. And my videos are still nowhere near where I want to be. But what I found fascinating is when something like a Woody Allen documentary comes out, I think, how is someone filming about a filmmaker going to make that film? And I have a look at the shots that they take, and I go onto YouTube and I have a look at the popular channels. Is that something we can do to educate ourselves about filmmakers' eye?
I think it's the best way to do it is to look at what other people are doing and look at things like film and TV around you with more of a conscious, critical eye. So, for instance, when I first started working in video, I'd go to the DVD store and just hire a pile of videos and sit and watch my way through all of them with a notebook and a pen. And I'd write down all the cool ideas that I'd see, and I'd think about how I can, you know, implement them in my own work. So, you know, when you watch TV, don't just lose yourself in an escapist way. I would say watch the show consciously and start to think about what kind of lighting that they're using, where are the lights placed, where are the shadows, and what sort of emotional or psychological context is that lighting creating. And, you know, it's not just film and TV that you can look at. Things like painting and photography, you know, will inspire, you know, plenty of ideas that you can build on.
I love it. You know, I formed the conclusion looking at some of these TV shows that they can't afford a tripod because some of them have like a really shaky style happening.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I suppose when you're watching, you know, ask yourself, I would say to people, ask yourself questions like, oh, I wonder why they're doing it that way. You know, what effect is it? And with the handheld thing, it's more of a realistic, immediate documentary style thing that might capture, you know, a more realistic sort of feel. So when people make films or videos, they've consciously made decisions about why they film something a certain way, and that's gonna get the best result. So, you know, this stuff about the filmmaker's eye, there's probably, you know, people out there who might think, ah, you know, that's not really necessary. I just need to set up the camera and go for it. But I can tell you that these are things that I've used to really make my work stand out. And thinking about these sort of things, you can really set your work apart from your competitors and become a better storyteller.
I love it. I'm really interested in filmmaker's eye. Thank you for sharing that. Now, I've heard you tell me before that sound is important. In fact, anyone I've spoken to about video tells me that it's more important than the images, which sounds strange when you're talking about a visual medium, but maybe you can expand on that for me.
Yeah, the reason why I say that is because if your content is great, people are going to forgive poor quality pictures. And, you know, this gets proved on things like YouTube every day. And that's the reason why you'll see really horribly shot footage on the news if there's some really compelling content in there. But if your sound quality is poor, if people can't hear what you're saying properly, they can't understand you, they're going to switch across to something else. They'll disengage and you'll lose them. So if you've got a good story to tell, it's vital that you can be, you know, clearly heard and understood.
Nice. Okay, so I took on board your information and I actually started using an external recorder and investing a little bit more into quality microphones. And the interesting thing is that if I do go a bit ghetto or whatever, people notice it. They say, you know, in fact, yesterday someone said, hey, this video doesn't look like your normal videos. I'm like, yeah, well spotted, you know, because I might have had a technical glitch or whatever. And I must admit, it's damn frustrating when you're starting to learn about this stuff, getting the right settings and whatever. If you haven't been to film school, you haven't filmed 100 documentaries, there's a bit of a steep learning curve to get the mix right. But maybe you could tell us about the typical scenario where you sort of break away from just using that built-in mic. What's the step we should take and make it easy on ourselves?
Okay, sure. So there's a microphone built into your camera, and often it's a fairly poor quality microphone. Usually the camera manufacturers haven't spent a lot of money on it to keep the cost of the cameras down. And the way that those microphones work is they capture the general sound around the camera. So they'll just as much record what's behind the camera and in front of the camera. It's not isolating the sound of the person speaking. And you can usually tell when someone's using a built-in microphone because it might sound a little bit tinny, a little bit thin. There's quite a bit of background noise, and, you know, often there's quite a bit of hiss as well. So you end up competing with all of the sounds around you, which can be quite distracting for the viewer. And so that's why you'd use something like an external microphone, which basically, like as the name implies, just means a microphone outside of the camera. And the most common microphone that I think your listeners would be using for face-to-camera videos and interview videos are lapel microphones.
That's one you clip onto your shirt.
That's right. It's a little microphone with a clip that you clip onto your shirt that sometimes you might see a news presenter or a reporter using.
I've got this cool one. It's called a pin mic, and you snap the top of it off. You stick pins through your shirt and then pop the top on. So all you see is this little tiny black thing, if you notice it at all.
That's pretty cool because it's disguising the microphone, and so it's not taking people's attention away. I mean, that being said, I think these days people are so used to seeing those little lapel microphones that it's not even a distraction. And
well, if someone's even holding a mic, it could almost look like they're professional.
Yeah, look, that's right, because that's also something people see on TV all the time. And the most important thing is just getting that microphone in really close to the source of the sound so it's concentrating on your voice. So if you don't have a lapel microphone, if you've got a handheld microphone, you know, you can use that, or you can even hold the microphone just out of shot. The key is getting that microphone in nice and close. And I think, you know, the thing with something like using an external microphone like a lapel mic is it just becomes an essential tool. You know, I think of it like a surfer needing a wetsuit or a runner with running shoes. It's just part of the gear that you need to do your job properly.
You're right. You know, we're recording this call at the moment and I'm using a quality microphone because I want to make it easy on the listener, and I'll put some effort into making sure that it sounds good. Something that you taught me as well, which, you know, when I got a better quality microphone, I also got a shotgun microphone, and you taught me that you have to be conscious about whatever's behind you when you use those because it's very sensitive and it can even pick up a computer power in the background. You know, I can hear a computer whining, so I have to go and turn the computer off and unplug it if I want to use that type of microphone, if I don't have a boom and I can't point it to the carpet or whatever. So there's all these little things to be aware of, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the way that we're recording now is that we've consciously chosen a fairly quiet space to record where there's not a lot of competing sounds. And that's the same process that people should go through when they're recording video. So it's interesting, you know, the way the human brain works. It's almost like our brain has made some kind of pact with our ears to filter out competing sounds. So you may think that there's not a lot of noise around you, but if you just sit quietly for a minute and start to tune into your environment, you can start to notice all sorts of sounds that your ears filtered out. So things like a bit of a hum from the computer, or birds chirping, or a kind of distant rumble of traffic, or the sound of the wind blowing the leaves. There's all these little sounds that all can add up to just diminishing the quality of the sound a little bit.
Right. So as you're talking, I can hear a propeller airplane going over my house, and I'm using a microphone that is fairly directional. So it sort of focuses on where I'm talking, and hopefully it's going to filter out a lot of the other noises. If the airplane was still in there, is there anything I could do about it?
Look, there are ways of adding filters and stuff like that later on to improve the sound quality. And, you know, there's an old saying in the film industry, which is sort of a bit of a joke, where people say, we'll fix it in post, which means we'll fix it in the editing. And Sometimes people think that it's just a case of applying a sort of magic filter and all the noise in the background is going to disappear and you're going to end up with great sound, but it's not really true. A really highly skilled audio technician can do stuff to improve the quality of sound, but of course that's going to be expensive and time-consuming. Just to give a bit of background about the way these audio filters work is that they remove a small part of the audio frequency. So they might remove the part of the frequency of that background noise, but it's also removing a little bit of your voice as well, and it's going to kind of diminish the depth. So I would say, this idea of I'll fix it in post, forget about that, get it right the first time and save yourself, a lot of time and hassle down the track. So, sound is a massive topic. There's so much there, but really just those two things, using a lapel microphone and thinking about the sounds that are around you and choosing a place that diminishes background noise is just going to make a massive difference to the quality of your sound.
Yeah, that certainly saved me because I've sort of realized that if you have a messy recording and inputs, then it takes ages to edit. And if it's the end of the day and I'm tired, I tend to just not want to do it. So now when I film something, if I realize there's something tragic happening, I usually just stop and then start again and just I want to get it as close to the end product in the first shoot.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we're not doing live TV here. You can go back and edit. But particularly for people who are doing things like your regular news broadcasts, you want to limit the amount of time that you're spending on it so you can work it into your routine and it's not taking up a massive part of your day. So getting these technical things right are going to save you or your team plenty of time down the track.
And something else you taught me, which is absolutely golden, is that you can put them into different sequences when you finish. So I know sometimes I'll just run, record the whole thing, and then I'll replace a part where there was a terrible noise afterwards, and then I know I can just chop that part back in. Instead of having to try and play around with filters or whatever, I just cut it out and move that new piece in.
You can do that. And I suppose if you are thinking about editing later on, the key is to not record any poor sort of background noise. So for instance, if you're recording and there's a plane in the background and then you cut and suddenly the plane is gone, that's going to be really obvious and that cut is going to be distracting, because a lot of this, it's not just about having something glossy and shiny and impressive for the sake of it. It's about not diverting your audience's attention away from you and onto the sound. So if you are going to be editing, then if there is something like a plane that comes over, just cut and do that part again so you're not going to have that kind of noise and then no noise juxtaposition, which is just going to sound weird and distracting.
Exactly. So what I'm talking about is I just let the tape run and then I just say the bit that I want again and then I just go and pop that out and slide it back into it and replace the noisy plane or the dog barking or any number of natural disasters that can happen on a farm here.
It's probably just worth mentioning that sometimes some of those things can just add a bit of character and quirkiness. Like I know that, sometimes if you've done a podcast and your dog has barked in the background, that's just been something that's kind of set the scene that, you're in a home-based environment and that's revealed a little bit more about your situation. So, not every bit of background noise is a mistake. You've also talked about having the chirping of birds in the background, which again adds kind of a little bit of your context and your story. So sometimes those things are nice to leave in as well.
But that's true. And when I was traveling and I didn't have my tripod and the kids were holding the camera and they were they just couldn't hold it up for too long and they started dropping it. I was working, lowering myself to still be in the shot, and then I sort of laughed about it. And sometimes I use the outtakes. And I think I connected more with my audience for leaving that in, for being honest and, capturing that moment than to try and have a slick production in that case.
I think so. And it's good to know the rules and then it's good to know when to break them and when that's actually going to enhance your videos.
That is awesome. Okay, so we probably should move on to lighting now because I know that's another important fundamental. And I've heard you talking about the difference between natural light and artificial light and, never the two should meet and all this sort of stuff. Is it true? Is it false? Like, how do you do this? And my cheat, of course, is I'm usually filming outside because it's much easier to set up.
That's exactly right. So let's talk about natural light versus artificial light. And, you know, by natural light, I basically just mean the light that's already there. So the sun, for example, and artificial light just refers to the light that you set up specifically for filming. And there's pluses and minuses for both. And sometimes you'll be using both at the same time. So just starting off with natural light, like you mentioned, the advantage is that there's very little setup time. You're working with the light that's already there. On the other hand, the disadvantage is that you have less control and the light can vary quite widely over a short period of time. So especially in a place like Melbourne where I am, where we have a lot of variable weather and clouds, you know, coming in and out, you can start filming with one particular lighting condition and within a couple of minutes, the light may have changed completely. So that's something that you have to be aware of, particularly for longer style videos. If you're doing the shorter, you know, 1 or 2 minute videos, that's not as much of an issue.
I imagine you'd have to have a raincoat for your camera in Melbourne.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Depending on what camera you've got. I think my camera can handle a little bit of rain, but that's definitely helpful. So just a little bit more about working with natural light. If you're filming outside and there's some quite harsh direct light, most of the time it's going to be better to actually just go into the shadows. You know, sometimes people think I need to have sunlight shining onto my face for it to look good, but if it's a really bright sunny day, it's going to create some quite harsh, unflattering shadows on your face.
Yeah, there's no way I could do that. I actually wait till the afternoon, and when the sun disappears over the house, I film in the front garden and the sun is hidden, but it's going over my head and it's shining on all the greenery behind me. So I'm filming in, I guess, the shade, and all the stuff behind me is lit up, but my camera's sensitive enough to be able to get the right exposure, even on an automatic setting. So it comes out okay, but I couldn't look at the direct sunlight, no way.
That's a really good way to go, because what you're basically getting there is a much softer, more even, more flattering light. A lot of that is actually just reflected light. So generally, that's going to look a lot better. And, you know, on that topic of reflected light, once you look around you, so much of the light outside is actually bouncing from, you know, one surface to another. So, for instance, when I'm filming in an office in the city, often I'll notice that the sun's shining, it's actually bouncing off an office building next door and coming into the room. And these are some of the sorts of things that you can use, because that reflected or bounced light is so much more flattering and better looking than the direct harsh sunlight.
Now, what about if you have artificial light and natural light? So you're sort of near a window like you just described. Is that, like, do you start to combine techniques, or is there some tricks to that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time you are going to have no choice but to combine things. You know, you might be inside in an office, but you might not be able to completely close all the blinds and shut off all the natural light from coming out. So sometimes you're actually going to be mixing two light sources, and it's important to know that the lights indoors are actually a different color to the outside light. So if you look at a sort of color spectrum, the outside light is more of a blue light and the indoor light is more of an orange light. And it's important to just be aware of that and make sure that when you're filming, you're not ending up with, you know, if you're filming yourself or a subject, ending up looking kind of really orange, or on the other hand, really blue. Now that's called white balance, and I don't want to get too technical, but that's, if people are interested in following that up, it might be worth Googling that and learning about white balance and learning how to set your white balance on your camera.
Good. I know I've got mine set to AWB, which is auto.
Yeah, that's a pretty safe way to do it. I mean, the only...
It is for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've got three main ways that I film. I film outside, I film inside, and I film in my three-car garage, which has the permanent setup of black, white, or green screen, and the lights set up in the way that you're probably going to tell me about, like a three-point lighting setup.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you just mentioned automatic white balance, and that's worth just generally touching on the automatic functions of the camera. Often you'll hear professionals say, never use the automatic functions on a camera. Now, I wouldn't say that should be 100% blanket rule, particularly for people shooting short web videos for YouTube. Sometimes your automatic setting is going to give you the best results. The one thing you need to watch out for is if there's a lot of light behind you and your camera's set to automatic exposure, it's going to make you look too dark in the frame because it's averaging out the light that's in the frame and giving a kind of approximate calculation. So I'm sure people have seen this sort of thing where they've used an automatic setting on their camera, they're filming someone with a window in the background, and you get that silhouette sort of effect.
If you want to see that, just go to superfastbusiness.com and check out my logo, because that's exactly how I filmed that logo. When I was setting up the camera, I did autofocus and I got this dark shadow thing, and I realized I'm going to have to move my lights in a different fashion to get a result.
Yep, exactly right. And I suppose you saw that and thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. I'll get a shot of that. And sometimes these, accidents or errors can actually create, quite cool effects.
Oh, that was just my filmmaker's eye. Okay, play there, Ryan.
Very good. I like it. So then talking about using lighting, so artificial lighting, that's the thing that gives you a lot of control. And so I like that. I like to exert as much control as possible in the filmmaking process. And the potential disadvantage is that you're going to need to spend some money to buy yourself a lighting kit. It's going to take you longer to set up, and it's a little bit more of a learning curve to set up lights to make it look really good. So without going into too much detail on this, just to run through a few key points that I think are going to help people, there's basically two types of lights, and we've touched on this with talking about outdoor lights. There's hard lights or soft lights, and hard lights are like the lights that shine directly on you, like something like a lamp or a work light, which can create quite harsh shadows and be very bright. And then something like a soft light would be fluoro tubes or LED lighting, or a light with a soft box on it, which is basically reflected lighting, which is going to give you a much more soft, even better looking light. So for your face-to-camera web videos, you want to be using soft lights.
Right. Yeah, that's good to know. And also, if you can find an area where you can leave them set up, that works out beautifully in terms of setup time. And if you're doing regular videos, so I've got my little favorite spots, and on occasion, if I'm doing a lot of videos, then I mark them out with a bit of tape so I can just set up in the same spot each time.
Yeah, that's a really good idea, because sometimes the setup can take longer than the actual filming. So that's a great idea. If you can't leave them set up, have some marks, or even draw a little plan of the way you had things set up if you come up with, a good lighting setup. So in terms of setting up your lights, the most standard textbook style of lighting is called three-point lighting. Now, again, I don't want to go into too much detail to sort of overwhelm people. So this is a good topic if people want to take their lighting to the next level, to do a search on three-point lighting, where you can see some diagrams of the way these lights are set up, and that's going to give you a better visual reference point. But it basically involves having a couple of lights in front of you and a light behind you. Now, you might wonder why you'd have a light behind you. What that basically does is put a bit of light on your shoulders and give a sort of halo effect around your head, and that separates you from your background. And if you start to look at TV shows and films with a more critical eye, you'll notice that they're using that sort of effect all the time to separate the subject from the background and give a little bit more of a 3D effect.
Awesome. Yeah, well, I hopefully you'll see an improvement in mine. I've started using the key light and the fill light and the backlight. Is that what you call them?
That's right. Yeah. So the key light is the brightest light that you're going to use, and that's going to be in front of you at about 30 to 40 degrees to the side. Your fill light is going to be in a similar position but on the other side, so you have one light to the left of you and one light to the right. Now, the reason why your key light is a little bit brighter than your fill light is because it's going to make the one side of your face slightly brighter, which is going to create a little bit more of a contour sort of effect. So if both of those lights were the same brightness, your face would look a lot flatter, whereas this is going to give more depth. And that's what a lot of lighting is all about. It's turning this flat 2D image that we're working with into more of a 3D sort of look with more depth. And then your backlight is, as I mentioned, the light that's in the back. You don't want that to be too bright, but just to cast a little bit of light on your shoulders and on your head to separate you from your background. So this is the most standard style of lighting, and I'd encourage the listener to start experimenting with that sort of lighting.
Awesome. Okay, so is this expensive?
You can spend a lot of money on this stuff. I have, but there's also you also don't need to spend too much money. I mean, I think you can get some really decent lights from, you know, places like YouTube. The thing is that they're not exactly built to last and be moved around a lot. So if you're in an environment where you can just set up your lights in your office or your room and leave them, they're pretty much going to be fine, and you don't have to have the, you know, best quality lighting. On the other hand, if you're moving around a lot, those cheaper lights are going to break and die relatively soon. So I think for a few hundred dollars, you can get yourself set up with a really good softbox lighting kit, and that's a great place to start. And, you know, it is a bit of an expense to get started, but if this is going to be an ongoing campaign for listeners, something they plan to do for months and years, that's going to be money, you know, really well invested.
Awesome. Okay, now the next tip is something that I think is fascinating, because it's really easy to spot an amateur versus a professional using the composition rules. Could you tell us about that?
So this is the fourth of those four main tips that I've been going through, and it connects back to what I started with, which is about developing the eye of the filmmaker. So composition basically just means how you set up your shot and how you arrange things within the frame. And it's interesting, because there's a few standard rules that it seems like humans are almost pretty much hardwired with. So if you look at, like I mentioned, photography and painting and films, you'll start to notice that basically people frame people up that they're filming or painting or photographing in almost the same way. And often these same sort of rules of composition apply. So I'm going to mention a few of those. And the reason why people do it is because it just looks more natural. It looks more visually pleasing, and it looks more professional. And by following these rules, you're just not going to distract the viewer away from your content by kind of thinking, oh, I wonder why he's framed it up that way. You know, on the other hand, if you're creating more of an experimental film, or you want to break the rules a little bit, you know, you can play with that stuff as well. So one of the most common mistakes that I notice with people when they're first learning photography or filming is that they'll put the person's face right in the middle of the frame. And that means that there's a lot of space between the top of the person's head and the top of the frame. And it almost like psychologically feels like you're diminishing the authority of the person. And it just doesn't look quite right. So the first step for framing up a person that you're interviewing or yourself is, imagine a couple of horizontal lines going across your frame. So you've got one line at the top third of the frame and another line at the bottom third of your frame. So you've broken up your frame into three thirds. The person's eye should be roughly along the top horizontal line. So have a look at paintings, have a look at photography. You'll see that setup is just, you know, really commonly repeated, and it just seems to look the most natural.
Nice. What else you got?
Okay. Well, that's sort of referred to as the rule of thirds. And if you start to look at pictures in terms of thirds, you'll notice that a lot of things are framed up in thirds. So if you see a photo of a landscape and you've got the sea and the land in the background, you won't see the line of the horizon in the middle of the frame. You'll see it either at the top of the top third of the frame or the bottom third of the frame. And the same applies for vertical lines as well. You're going to see this theme repeated over and over. You know, often in an interview, you'll have the person sitting on the left-hand side of the frame, and then you'll have something else on the right, like a, you know, computer or a tree or something like that. So as you're watching, you know, films and TV, start to notice this rule of thirds. There's one more rule about lines, and that's diagonal lines. And again, you'll notice that a lot of films, objects with diagonal lines will be in the frame. And this is about creating a sense of depth. So it might be, let's say there's a person standing on the side of the road. You'll notice the road will make a diagonal line going off into the distance. And that's going to create that illusion of depth. So you're trying to capture the real world on a 2D sort of space. So it's interesting. Once you become aware of these rules, you'll see these sort of things all the time. But probably the most important rule about composition is use it to tell your story better. So often when people start, they'll just kind of plonk the camera on a tripod or hold it and just film a person wherever they are. But once you start to make conscious decisions about what's going to appear in your frame, you're going to add a lot to your video, and you're going to use it as a storytelling tool. So, for instance, one of the videos that I made recently is with someone giving tips about stockbroking. And so we filmed him with a background of, you know, three or four computers in the background, and the computers had stock charts and, you know, sort of like that stock ticker sort of thing, and stock market websites. And that's you know, a congruent image to have for someone like that, that's helping to tell his story, that's setting him up as an authority, that's showing that he's keyed into the market. And so when you're filming people, think about what are the things that you can have in the background of your frame that can help tell your story. So I really like your videos, James, because part of your story is someone who works from home, and, you know, you sort of reveal part of, you know, the way that you live your life through backgrounds, and often that's kind of so much more interesting than just having like a really stark white background.
Yeah, and I got plenty of reactions when my background was the Colosseum or the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Yeah,
on my travels, you know, it does definitely develop the story. You know, it's obvious that today I'm not in my front garden or backyard or my garage. I'm now somewhere else. You know, where could I be? Why am I traveling? And I got so much reaction from just changing the background to my video. You know, even with a worse camera and less equipment, that was such a compelling part of the package.
Definitely, because you're creating kind of a sense of connection and intimacy, so people kind of feel like they're there with you along the journey. And you know, some of the other videos that you made while you were traveling, you talked a bit about particular businesses and how they market themselves, and you had shots of those businesses and designs and stuff like that in the background, which just gave so much more context than you just kind of standing there or, you know, on the side of the road or in a car. So always, you know, I would say to listeners, think consciously about what you're putting in your background and how is it helping to enhance your story.
That's a good one. You know, that the point that I was working with there is I've learned something, and I think it was from my friend Alexei Nearklaus, was if you say something, back it up with proof. So, you know, when I talk about an automated vending machine store, it is more powerful to actually show it than just to talk about it. So, you know, even though I was definitely compromised with my equipment, I had a 10-year-old cameraman, I had an iPhone, you know, so we had traffic noise. We were really working against the odds, and then every few minutes a person would come into the store. So we just had to hit and run that story, but it was really fun to make, and it was better to have that story than to not have that story.
Definitely. Your videos worked really well. You know, they were authentic. They were natural. You kind of felt like you were there along the way. And so that's why, you know, it's really important to know these professional tips, but to use them consciously, because you might have created something that was kind of so technically slick, it might have taken all the sort of magic away from the video. So a lot of the times it's good to, you know, think about it and then go, oh, you know, is this background noise going to add to it? Is kind of a little bit of shaky camera just going to make it feel more real? So it's not to say kind of don't do those things, but just do them as a conscious decision.
What about things like outtakes? You know, my concern was that people might think I'm unprofessional, but then in reality, I think people almost kind of watch the video to find out what I'm going to stuff up today, and they actually watch the video all the way to the end. I know this from my analytics, and partially maybe they want to see the outtakes, and maybe because a lot of my audience are at a similar stage to me, just sort of struggling with this whole, technology or using a whiteboard or a teleprompter. Is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? What's your feeling as a professional? Like, you probably would never put that in a documentary with a government organization, or would you?
Well, there's this phenomenon of the blooper reel, you know, and people just love blooper reels. They, you know, they love to see kind of the mistakes and the funny situations and the kind of unplanned stuff. And also, people are so visually literate, you know, they understand the conventions of film and video production. So when you slot those on at the end, people know it, that, you know, that they're familiar with it. It's not like they're going to go, oh, you know, why did that just pop up there? They understand that sometimes in films there's a blooper reel and it pops in at the end. So it's just all about choosing kind of, you know, the right context. And with what you're doing, you're having a conversation with people. You're not trying to look too professional and corporate. You know, you want it to be a little bit fun. And like you say, what a great strategy to have people watching through till the end. So, I reckon it works really well in that situation.
I usually make sure I put it after the bumper so that, you know, it's a clear delineation. Okay, you know, the show's over. You know, now here's the other bits. Well, you know what? I think we're probably going to just do a quick summary just to make sure that we lock in these points. But you've sort of introduced us to some, you've taken us inside the filmmaker's eye, and you've given us some insight into what's happening. You know, what are we actually watching and what are we listening to? We've talked about sound and how important that is. We've talked about lighting, both natural and artificial. We've talked about composition, so how to actually frame up the shot and some of the rules. And we've got a new understanding. And so we've got all these little Spielbergs and Kubricks out there now ready to hit the world and create stuff. Have you got any closing comments, Ryan?
Well, I think that it's important to think of this as an ongoing process. So I've been making films for over 15 years, and I'm just learning as I go, and I'm sometimes making mistakes, and sometimes I do something, you know, really cool, and I sort of file that away and think, oh, you know, I'll do that again. Sometimes I see ideas from other people and I incorporate that into what I'm doing. But it's just an ongoing process, and it's a process of making something, putting it out there, watching it with a critical eye and thinking, you know, what do I love about what I did there? What could I improve a little bit? And getting feedback from people and putting that on board. But the reason why I love it is because you're just creating something from an idea and putting it out there and sharing it with people and getting, you know, and getting a reaction. And anyone can do that now. There's no impediment. There's no cost. You know, it doesn't have to be a factor. It's accessible to all of us.
It's so satisfying. Well, I just want to say thanks, Ryan. Be sure to check out Ryan's show. It's called Web Video Marketing Show. It's on iTunes. I've listened to every episode. I love it. Keep up the good work. And thanks for helping all of our listeners.
Thanks for having me on the show, James. I really enjoyed it.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com.